Hey, everybody, welcome into episode number 89 of Toeing the Slab, Pitching with David Cone. It is a production of John Boy Media, and it is weekly pitching talk with the five-time World Series champ, the former Cy Young Award winner David Cone, the research ace James Smythe, and myself, Justin Shackle. We have producer Dan Rourke out of Twitter jail. He's out on parole. We're keeping a sharp eye on Dan Rourke throughout this episode. Right out of the gate here, we apologize in advance if the audio quality isn't exactly up to par what you're used to here. David and I were on the road. I'm working on the earphones. I think it's going completely earphone free here. We're in the same hotel, David. I think you're hogging up a lot of the Wi-Fi, so just be careful there. But guys, first and foremost here, as we open the show, let's get right into the opener. A little bit of a mini controversy, mini drama in Toronto on Monday between the Yankees and the Blue Jays. Aaron Judge absolutely crushing his second home run of the night, but he was shown glancing at the Yankee dugout. The Blue Jays TV broadcast kind of made a big deal out of it. What's your take on Judge glancing at the dugout moments before he crushes a 462-foot home run, I should say?
Yes, right. I mean, that was just an unbelievable, massive blow that only Aaron Judge and maybe Giancarlo Stanton can hit him quite like that. I guess if the shoe were on the other foot, so to speak, and the situation were reversed, that you might be a little suspicious, certainly. You'd wonder, why are you peeking over at your dugout? Now, Aaron Judge's explanation was, there was some chirping at the umpire going on. Aaron ended up getting thrown out of the game on arguing balls and strikes. So certainly that's something that's plausible in my mind, that that's what he was doing. He didn't want to be distracted by the dugout. Like, that was enough after the game. He talked about, that's enough. We're up 6-0. Let's not, I'm batting here. Can you let me hit? So if you want to break it down and say, okay, what's going on? If there was something nefarious going on, okay, what could it possibly be? It's not pitch comm. Nobody's, there's no sign stealing anymore. There's no fingers going down for signal calling. So did somebody hack pitch comm all of a sudden? I doubt that's the case. Then it goes right to tipping. Is a pitcher tipping his pitches? And did Aaron Judge look at the first base coach or somebody at the end of the dugout to sort of give him a cue what was coming? And that would be based on a pitcher changing his glove, moving his glove around, or some sort of tell, like a poker game. But he has a tell. Now, generally, the batter would pick that up in the box better than anybody else. You have the best view right at the pitcher if the pitcher's doing something different on a slider as opposed to a fastball. So Paul O'Neill always talked about this. That is such a distraction. If that's your plan, and right before the pitch is delivered, when the pitch does tip his pitch, you look to the dugout to get the signal and then try to pick up and focus on the release point momentarily or just a split second later. Boy, that's really a high degree of difficulty to pull that off. I highly doubt that anything like that was going on. But nonetheless, it became a story last night. And it's something that obviously the Blue Jays are going to watch. And now everybody's keyed in on watching where Aaron Judge's eyes go in his at-bat.
This seems like a very silly non-controversy to me. In Toronto, in over the last 10 or so years, when it was like the Joey Bats, Edwin Encarnacion, Josh Donaldson era, bashing Blue Jays, there were periodically complaints that teams would say, oh, they're stealing signs and looking into the windows and everything. And that was similar sort of, so they're going to be looking up into a window or up somewhere else and then glancing back and forth all while the pitch is about to be thrown to you. This seems like a bit of a ridiculous non-story.
Now, it happened after Judge's manager Aaron Boone was ejected for arguing balls and strikes. There was a pitch earlier in that at-bat that was well below the knees of Judge. Hey, we've been here before. It was called a ball. Aaron Boone had enough. John Schneider had issues with balls and strikes all night as well. So Boone was ejected. Aaron Judge said that players were continuing to chirp at the home plate umpire. That's why he glanced over. Look, this is where we're at with all, with the game, with where we're after the sign stealing drama with the Houston Astros. Is that a plausible excuse from Aaron Judge?
All of this is, I think it is. Yes, I do believe that's plausible. But nonetheless, as I said before, if the Blue Jay hitters were peeking in their dugout before the pitch came, I think it would raise some eyebrows and certainly some suspicions on why and what's going on. So it's a follow now. You know, when you're playing the Blue Jays, everybody on the Blue Jay side is going to be watching Aaron Judge's eyes, including the Blue Jays production truck who picked up on that. So yeah, it's something to follow. I'm with James. It's probably a big nothing burger, but nonetheless, you know, it's not going to go away right away. It's going to keep some eyes on Aaron Judge, at least for this particular series, as we continue on in this 4-game set. Now, as far as Aaron Boone last night getting thrown out of the game, I kind of sensed, just trying to read the tea leaves, that sometimes a home plate umpires have different demeanors. Obviously, it's a human element. Some of them have real rabbit ears. They hear everything. You could say one thing to an umpire from the dugout, a lot of them will let it go a little bit. A veteran guy will let it go. Okay, have your say. Don't be abusive, but I'll let you have your chirping just a little bit. But it seemed like anybody chirped on either side, Van Drock, the home plate umpire, immediately would whip off his mask and look into the dugout. So to me, it's kind of a case of a young umpire with rabbit ears. And that's what Aaron Boone really got upset about. He kind of alluded to that after the – in the post game. It's like, hey, come on, you threw me out for that? I said one thing. You know, these umpires today are lucky. You're lucky you didn't have Billy Martin or Earl Weaver, you know, back in the day, because that was real abuse right then. But you should have a little leeway to post an objection on the strike zone without getting thrown out of the game. It seemed like there was some rabbit ears and some quick hooks going on last night.
Yeah, I think you even saw it early in the game with the Blue Jays dugout too. So a fun fact about Aaron Boone's ejection: that was his 28th career ejection as a manager. That's already tied for 63rd all time among big league managers, even though he's only 194th in games managed at 751. So he is on a big pace for ejections.
Two quick items from this whole thing from my end. If the Yankees were in fact signaling signs, maybe discovering something with Jay Jackson tipping his pitches, why is Aaron Judge the only hitter looking in there and maybe receiving these signs? That's one. Two, Jay Jackson could have not thrown a big fat breaking ball right over the middle of the plate that was as juicy as any pitch we saw on Monday night at Rogers Center. And there were a lot, because Alek Manoah was on the mound. We're going to get to that later on in this podcast, but let's move on, gentlemen. There are two teams atop their respective divisions, both in the Eastern divisions, the Rays in the AL East, the Braves in the NL East. Both have some concerning injuries to their pitching staff. So I'm wondering which first place team's pitching injuries are more concerning, Atlanta's or Tampa Bay's?
Well, you know, this is a conversation that James and I have had over the years in terms of starting rotation, depth, the use of the bullpen, everything. One thing leads to another, but I got to go with the Rays just because of how well that the Springs was pitching. He was on top of his game. You could see it coming over the last couple of years, and Rasmussen as well. So when you lose Springs and Rasmussen, and then on top of that, back to spring training, remember Shane Baz is out too, a young former number one draft pick that they were high on as well as a starting pitcher. So really that's three. That's three starters they've lost, but two that were on top of their game that we don't know. We know Springs is out for the year, probably on into next year as well. And Rasmussen, all of a sudden, he throws seven shutout innings and immediately goes on the 60-day IL. That was just alarming to me. It's like, this guy looked fantastic, shutting out the Yankees for seven innings. And then all of a sudden, after the game, you hear, oh, it's 60-day DL the next day. So to me, that's really concerning, especially how good he is. You know, you're talking about Rasmussen was in the top five pitchers in the American League going right now, the way he was throwing the ball. And Springs as well was what was up there, I think, top 10 with the way he was throwing the ball as well. So that's a huge blow for the Rays in my mind. They probably will get Glasnow back at some point, but he also left his recent rehab start with tightness in his side coming back from an oblique injury. So, you know, the hits keep coming for the Rays right now. And the story's been their offense, swinging the bat, hitting home runs. But at some point, you keep losing starters like that. It's a serious red flag.
I think it is the Rays. They've been able to get by without Glasnow, and they've been playing amazing ball. But Rasmussen dropping, that this is just a compounding factor. Are we starting to see some cracks in the bullpen? It's a little more of a red flag for a team like Tampa Bay that's so reliant on the relief corps. And another thing that's a little a little backwards, but I'm more confident in the Braves offense to paper over any pitching troubles than I am in the Rays to sustain this kind of hitting streak that they're on. So I'm going to go with Tampa Bay there. It's big that they get Pete Fairbanks back off the injured list to bolster the bullpen. And like Coney said, Glasnow should be coming back. But I think I'm a little more concerned about the Rays pitching injuries right now.
Yeah, they do get Pete Fairbanks back. The bullpen hasn't been as solid as it has in recent memory. And it's wild because you see this historic start. But Fairbanks' return allows Jason Adam to kind of morph back into that setup role. But the Braves, I mean, we talked about it last week with Max Fried going on the IL. Now they lose Kyle Wright. He automatically goes to the 60-day IL as well. But you have Charlie Morton, Spencer Strider, Bryce Elder. They're all really performing as the pitchers that are still anchoring that rotation. So I have more faith in the Braves rotation there. I have more faith in their bullpen as well. They just got Raisel Iglesias back. I know he hasn't gotten off to the best start, but goes back to the divisions too, right, guys? Like the overall depth of the NL East doesn't look like it's going to be what we thought it could be at the outset of this season. And I think they have enough to stay ahead of the pack in the Braves. The Rays, I don't think they're I don't think they're in trouble, so to speak, but I think they're definitely more vulnerable with their injuries. Rasmussen going down was a big gut punch. Moving over to the West, the National League West, a lot of fun. It's definitely more competitive, but I think the Dodgers are still showing that they're considered like the class of this division and maybe the class of the National League. They've won six straight at the time we're recording this year. Offense is mashing. The starting rotation has looked really strong. Can the Dodgers rotation sustain their current rate of success?
The short answer is yes, in my mind. Clayton Kershaw on top of his game. He's the leader of that staff, has been maybe the best starting pitcher of his generation. You look at his numbers. You want to go down a rabbit hole. Look at Clayton Kershaw's career numbers. Just unreal. His career ERA right at the top. Just remarkable, especially when you think of the sample size of work that he has. The Dodgers collectively as an organization are the envy of the industry. And it's two ways, the way they develop pitching. If they need somebody, they can go down in the minor leagues and bring them up. Now, Dustin May probably is the most recent example of that. After fully back from his Tommy John surgery, he looks legitimate like a frontline starter right behind Kershaw. There's more in the pipeline on the Dodger side too. You think about Bobby Miller, we haven't seen yet, is a top prospect that could be on the way. We've seen Gavin Stone already, and he kind of acquitted himself fairly well, even though he gave it up a little bit in his recent start. He still showed a lot of promise with a really plus changeup that he features. So, I believe the Dodgers on the offensive side, they're still doing what they always have done. They're collectively an approach where they walk a lot. They're very selective. Their walk rate is always up. And the strikeout rate is kind of low. I mean, they really have sort of this developmental mindset on the offense and the pitching side that just pays dividends for them. And they keep refreshing, hit the reboot button. And the Dodgers, oh yeah, this is going to be the year they fall off. No, it isn't. They're right there where, right there and very formidable, like they always have been, and like they've been, especially over the last 10 years.
Even if this is a sort of a reset season. We talked about this before the year and in spring training. The Dodgers, they are a default powerhouse until further notice. So if they keep winning games. The rotation's been fantastic. Julio Urias, 3.61 ERA. That's actually fourth out of the five guys that are in there now. Kershaw is still at the top of his game. Dustin May off to a fantastic start. Tony Gonsolin's back and he's pitched well in four starts. Noah Syndergaard bringing up the rear as the five starter, but maybe they can get him straightened out. But it does seem sustainable. These are mostly reliable guys in the big picture, so I don't see why they can't be one of the better rotations moving along. And Coney, you don't have to twist my arm to talk about the greatness of Clayton Kershaw. He has a 2.48 career ERA, and if you look at adjusted ERA or ERA plus, which compares you to the league average and adjust for ballpark, his career ERA plus is 1.57. That means he's been 57% better than the league over his career. That's the best for any pitcher who's pitched 2,000 innings in the major leagues, one of the all-time greats. And even though he's not a, you know, 180, 200 inning guy anymore, there's kind of this thinking that, oh, he's, you know, he's on the downturn or whatever, but he has a 2.36 ERA this year. And if you look at the last, say, few seasons where starting in, say, 2018, when he first started to get some injuries, well, since then, he has a 2.79 ERA over the last six seasons. So he's still going strong, even if he's going year to year with the Dodgers now, but he's still anchoring a powerhouse Dodger rotation.
It's funny, James, because you mentioned the pitcher with the fourth lowest ERA in that rotation being Julio Urias. That's the guy I think I have the most faith in over the long haul of this season. Tony Gonsolin is proving that all you need to wonder is whether he'll be healthy when he's on the mound. He looks like he's going to be producing. Can he stay healthy? Can Kershaw stay healthy? I love Clayton Kershaw, but the question always has to be there. How many innings is Dustin May going to be able to throw in his first full year back from Tommy John surgery? So, like, the one pitcher that I don't have any questions with is Urias. And, again, they're a force until they aren't. I'm a true believer in that. I think the rotation is a strength. But I also think that they're going to be adding to that rotation via a trade at some point. So we'll keep an eye out there with the Dodgers. All right, more Toe in the Slab is coming up. But for all the men out there, I need to tell you about a way you could step up your skincare. And that is something that the earlier you start, the easier it is to maintain. And Caldera Lab is here to help you raise the bar with your skincare. This company creates high-performance men's skincare products by combining pharmaceutical-grade science along with nature's purest and most potent ingredients. You want to go the all-natural route, believe me. Caldera Lab is backed by a leading clinical trial where 9 out of 10 men experienced healthier and visible improved skin. Caldera Lab has tools to unlock your best first impression and confidence. One of the main things that the females notice first is a man's skin. The Regimen Bundle from Caldera Lab, a twice-a-day routine to transform your skin. Inside this bundle, you're going to find the Clean Slate. It's a balancing cleanser that uses gentle plant-based cleansing. The moisturizer, called the Base Layer, it's a nutrient defense fortifying moisturizer, huge on hydration for the skin. And then the Good, their go-to at night before bed, and a clinically proven multifunctional scrum that helps your skin look tighter and smoother, as well as to help reduce visibility of wrinkles and fine lines, talking about the creases underneath your nose, the crow's feet by your eyes, the wrinkles on your forehead. You want to take your skin game to the next level. You could do it with Caldera Lab. Look no further than the icon as well. It's the serum for your eyes. It is here to address the three most common skin concerns around the eyes. Like we mentioned, the crow's feet, the fine lines, and also you want to eliminate those bags, the dark circles, the puffiness underneath your eyes. We have a great code for you. It is SLAB. And if you enter that at calderalab.com, you will get 20% off your order. That is 20% off at calderalab.com by using code SLAB. Unlock your youthful glow and be ready for summer with Caldera Lab. Moving back east, Toronto. Alek Manoah was at the front of this rotation. And before the season started, I think we named every other Blue Jays starter needing to step up in order for the Blue Jays to take that step forward and potentially come away with the AL East crown. But here we have Alek Manoah really struggling out of the gate on Monday against the Yankees. Those struggles reached another level. He walked a career high 7 batters. What is going on with Alek Manoah in Toronto?
Well, just watching him pitch last night, there were some red flags for me in body language. He threw a couple of sliders where he kind of wheeled around and showed his back to the catcher before he got the ball back, as if, you know, he's not happy or something's going on with Alek Manoah. And when you look under the hood, his slider has diminished over the years. He used to be one of the best even 2 years ago, and he's still a young pitcher. But 2 years ago, he had, I think, over 15 and a half inches of horizontal movement on that slider, kind of a sweeper, really good shape pitch in a pitch design, way of speaking. It's gone down to like 12 and a half inches. He's lost almost three inches of horizontal movement on that slider. Now, what comes with that is a little loss in spin rate, a little loss in the sharpness of the break and command overall. A lot of times he'd hang it. He wouldn't finish it last night. and then he'd throw one and he'd miss down and away. So the first thing that goes is the control with any of your pitches. And with Manoah, his slider's his best pitch, especially against right-handed batters. The command's off, the break is off, the spin's a little down, the sharpness is a little down. Real red flag for me. I'm wondering if he's nursing something. Is he okay? I don't know. It's purely speculative on my mind, but that's the first red flag that you look for somebody, especially who's got a really sharp breaking slider, that his signature pitch isn't quite the same. And, you know, what's going on with it and how's he feeling?
Well, we don't know, but it's such a red flag when you have a guy who's a great pitcher for his first two big league seasons, and to have this kind of decline is really jarring. And you just start off with the walk rate. It's doubled from his first two seasons. It was around 7%, better than league average. Now it's 15%. And we saw the seven walks on Monday night. The slider, one of the better pitches, and it's been getting hammered. So he's been losing location and walking guys, but even when it's around the plate, it's getting tattooed a .368 average and .737 slugging percentage against the slider for Manoah. This is not the guy we're used to seeing.
Guys, are we at the point in this division where the individual blips from certain players like could mean everything for a chance at a division title for these teams? Like, each team obviously has flaws, and that includes the Rays. We were going over them moments before with their rotation injuries. Someone obviously has to win the AL East, but like, how much are the flaws magnified on the individual players' ends who are struggling with these reduced head-to-head matchups?
Yeah, everybody's got issues, right? We all tend to, you know, each individual fan base tends to focus in on your own individual problems. And in the big view, to your point, Shaq, it's a great point, is that the schedule's different this year. These games mean more. Interdivision, four-game series in Toronto means a little bit more in May than it did last May, because you're not going to see these guys as much, obviously, this year. And it also puts more emphasis on the next series for the Yankees, going down to Cincinnati, taking advantage of the second division clubs. So far, so good with the Yankees as they start this swing of their schedule. You know, they swept the A's. Now, obviously, these games are important with the Blue Jays. What happens in Cincinnati over the weekend? Can they make hay down there? That's how the Rays built their lead. I think James has showed us some numbers, but their record against those second division or well below 500 teams is just incredible. That's how they got to 20 games over 500. They were almost 20 games over 500 against those teams, I think. They've 16, 17, or 18 games over 500. The Rays played against teams like Oakland and the second division team. So, yeah, the schedule means something this year. It's the first year we've had it. So it's something that where you could see most of the wildcard teams come out of the American League East this year with the expanded playoff format. So I'm watching that as well. Yankee fans, oh, the Yankees were in last place. Yeah, but they were a half game out of the last wild card too. So you have to really take a look at the big picture here and how many teams the American League East is going to get in terms of playoff picture.
Well, the Rays have gotten fat on some of the dregs of the league. 14-2 combined record against the White Sox, Reds, Rockies, Royals, A's, and Nats. Some of the team, the Red Sox hadn't even played any of them yet. The Yankees only had the three games recently against Oakland, so a lot of that's going to shake out. The AL East is such a grinder. It's you look at the record that the teams have head-to-head, everyone's kind of beating up on each other in the head-to-head division records. But you look at how some of these teams are doing outside the AL East. The Rays are 21-4. The Orioles are 20-9. The combined record for the five American League East teams against teams that are outside the division is 93-48 as of when we're recording this on Tuesday. That's a .660 winning percentage that comes out to 107 wins per 162 games. So these teams are crushing the rest of the competition, but within the AL East, it's so tight. And with the schedule, you're going from one head-to-head game is 1 out of 19 over the last, you know, 20 years or so. Now you're down to 13 head-to-head games. And so that's each individual game is carrying about 50% more impact in your division race.
Hands down, the AL East, pound for pound, the best division so far here in 2023. No question about it. We all saw this fastball from Aroldis Chapman of the Kansas City Royals within the last week. Triple digits, had insane movement up and away against a right-handed hitter. Chapman has not allowed a home run at the time we're recording this. And Aroldis Chapman's also pitching in one of the weakest divisions in baseball, in the AL Central. Now, the Kansas City Royals, they are not going anywhere. But as we get deeper into the season, again, now reaching the midpoint of May, guys, how much longer should the Royals wait before they trade Aroldis Chapman?
Well, I think that they should have traded him after opening day when he was throwing 104. But as we know, a lot of times if teams are struggling, oh, they got to make a trade. Well, teams aren't really, this isn't really on the radar in mid-May at this time. So when do you guys think is the earliest that really starts to happen? Early June, mid-June?
Yeah, the art of the deal, right? You have an asset, you know you're going to trade him. How do you maximize that leverage? You get more teams involved in the bidding process, right? It's classic supply and demand. It's classic art of the deal. It's going to be interesting to follow. But the one caveat to your point, Jack, and to your point, James, especially, was we know as Yankee fans, we've seen Aroldis Chapman blow up. We know that, you know, we've seen it overnight. And so the longer you wait, you know, what happens? You know, what happens if he does? If there's an injury, he's a little older now. Does he break down? Does he start to lose the command and the radar again all of a sudden and go into a bit of a funk and diminish his value? So, yeah, it is an interesting case study in terms of when's the right time to pull the plug, because there's no doubt the Royals are – they signed him for leverage. They signed him with this in mind, that they could get some significant pieces in a trade to a team that's in the playoff hunt. That's an interesting follow now, especially where the Royals are in the standings. You know, there's no need for, you know, a closer that throws 104 miles an hour. That's a veteran at this point in their development or in their arc of where they're going to be as an organization.
And look, this is why they signed Aroldis Chapman as a free agent. If he was doing well, they were going to unload him in a trade. And I would err on the side of caution for the reasons you were talking about, David. We know this movie here. Even though he's looking great in a low-stakes environment in Kansas City, pitching in the AL Central, I think if there's that first desperate team, again, art of the deal, the first desperate team that comes along, I'd sell high on Aroldis Chapman at this point. And I think this brings us to our Yankee chat. So a former Yankee blending in right now. The Yankees have some issues in the bullpen, but in their starting rotation, a potential red flag, and it's someone who we would not expect to have a red flag from based on what we've seen the last couple of seasons. Nestor Cortez, over his last few starts, didn't sound like he was completely in love with his fastball command. There were signs that were pretty evident in certain outings versus others. And he really looked like he hit a dead end the third time through the Rays lineup in his most recent start. Gentlemen, does Nestor Cortez's recent issues concern you?
Well, you kind of hit the nail on the head, you know, that it's that third time through the order. The fifth inning has really kind of come back to haunt Nestor in a lot of his starts. I think his ERA in the fifth inning is well over 12. And most of the damage has been done then. It's kind of like he's cruising along, maybe a little first inning hiccup here and there in some of his starts. But then the middle innings have been pretty solid, the second, third, and fourth innings. And then all of a sudden, He comes unraveled, or so, you know, things start to steamroll on him in the fifth inning. And that's a familiar thing for me. I know when years that I struggled, it was always that one bad sequence, that one bad inning that got me. It's usually in the middle innings, the fourth, fifth, or sixth innings. And that's what's happened to Nestor. And I think, you know, when you look at Nestor and you look under the hood, you know, there's nothing really glaring overall. Like we said with Alek Manoah, like, oh no, his cutter's not cutting as much, or the quality of one of his significant pitches has dropped off. But I think overall, he's throwing less strikes. You know, in 2022, last year, he threw over 2-1 strikes to balls. This year, it's down to 1.7. Now, that doesn't sound significant, but that leads to, you know what, they're not chasing as much, so I have to throw more four-seam fastballs, or I'm falling behind a little bit more and become a little bit more predictable. And that's kind of playing out, too. If you look at the outside the zone chase rate on Nestor Cortez's pitches, that's down about 7 percentage points year over year from 22 to 23. So it's sort of one thing leads to another. I'm not throwing as many strikes. They're not chasing as much. Is there any one pitch that's the culprit? I'm not sure it is. You know, the quality of his cutter still looks good at times. His sweeping slider still looks decent at times compared to years past in terms of the movement profile. But overall, less strikes, a little more predictable. And the league's kind of figuring him out a little bit, kind of adjusting to Nestor Cortez now. And I really believe that he could benefit from something that moves the opposite direction, a changeup, a fading changeup that he's shown at times. He only throws it about 3% of the time. He threw it a little over 4.5% of the time last year. I know it's hard to kind of throw a pitch that's your fourth best pitch, but that, you know, if he can bring that along and show it at times, that might take some pressure off of him in terms of that cut fastball. And everything he throws from a left-handed batter moves left to right. You know, the four-seamer has some ride. His cutter moves left to right. His sweeper moves left to right. Something moving the other way, something moving right to left would really benefit him. And, you know, I don't know how he gets there, you know, unless he just keeps trying to throw that changeup, trying to get it to fade to right-handed batters.
His two worst starts as a Yankee have been in his last three, 7 runs against the Rangers, 6 runs against the Rays. These are two of the highest scoring offenses in the major leagues, by the way. But Coney mentioned some of the times through the order stuff that, you know, didn't really rear its head that much for him in these last couple of years. But if you look at the average first, second, third time through the order, 185 to 242 to 455. Slugging, 246 to 349 to 1121. That's a slug, not an OPS. But at the same time, there are some red flags, but also some reason for to temper the panic. Coney, the chase rate, you're spot on there, because last year he was in the top 35% of the league in getting batters to swing at pitches outside the zone. And so far this year, he's in the bottom 15% of the league. But if you look at his four-seam fastball, the average is jumped up. The opponent average is up from 157 last year to 253 this year. And the slugging is up about over 150 points. But the expected batting average, an expected slug that you get from StatCast, is pretty much in line with last year. So it kind of makes you think that maybe there's just been some unfortunate contact and some extra balls falling in or what have you there. So I think it is a little cause for concern, because he's just been so consistently great for the last, you know, two seasons. But just, I think it's a little, it's something to monitor, but not necessarily panic about right now.
It's sort of like a hitter, you know, hitters, we talk about ground ball rates. You know, Jordan Walker with the Cardinals got sent down because his ground ball rate was too high. You know, it's the same for a pitcher. You know, you just do the inverse for pitchers and ground ball rate and fly ball rate. Nestor's fly ball rate's about 10% up this year. And the home runs per fly ball, which can have a random variance to it as well, is up too. Well, about, you know, 1.5% in terms of the percentage of fly balls leaving the ballpark. But the question is he given more actions in the air against Nestor this year so far in his first 8 starts by about 10%. And that, you know, that may tend to level out over the course of a season, but that's something you look at right away. It's like, oh, they're laying off of the cutter in, they're squaring up some four seamers, and they're hitting it in the air more, and they're leaving the ballpark more. So that's something to follow with Nestor moving forward.
And there might be something to this with just his story, his breakout over the last couple of years has been so great to see. But does that also kind of lend itself? Is there a little more panic than you might see from a Garrett Cole or something if that was happening with him?
Right. We think that what we're seeing from Nestor Cortez obviously is real over the last 2 years, but is, like, you know, is the coach turning back into a pumpkin? I think that's on the mind of all Yankee fans here. One thing that is on my mind, guys, is the carryover effect. Nestor Cortez threw a career high in innings last year. I guess it kind of takes me back to Alek Manoah as well. He approached 200 innings last year. And when you cannot see the visible carryover effects in things like velocity, and Nestor Cortez is saying he's feeling fine, he's feeling strong, can the carryover effect still be a thing despite Cortez himself saying, no, I feel fine?
No, it's a valid point, you know, and also, you know, he's had some hamstring issues. He had he was behind the 8-ball in spring training a little bit in terms of his buildup and his endurance. So maybe he's not quite all the way built up like he was last year. Maybe that's why the fourth and the fifth innings, a lot of the damage is coming that third time through the order. Maybe it's because he's not quite all the way back physically compared to last year or the year before because of his lower half and his legs and, you know, what happened in spring training, a little bit of a hamstring issue last year as well. So maybe his legs aren't quite under him in terms of endurance. And that could come. Maybe moving forward, that will get better, you know, as he gets stronger. But yeah, it's that one bad inning. That one bad inning for Nestor usually comes about the fourth or the fifth inning this year, and it's something to follow.
All right, moving on to another piece of the Yankees rotation, one that it seems like the Yankees are going to be getting back relatively soon. Luis Severino is on a rehab assignment right now. Aaron Boone wouldn't completely tip his hand in saying that Luis Severino was going to be coming off the IL and making his season debut on Sunday, but it's certainly in play. Severino could be on the mound this Sunday against the Reds in Cincinnati. But through all of this rehab process, through this stint on the injured list for Luis Severino, feels like there's some back and forth tension between he and the organization in terms of what their vision is for him, their plan to get him rolling. Severino feels like, hey, I don't need these rehab assignments. I can throw the amount of the allotment of pitches that I'm throwing here in the majors. I'm ready to go. History would say he might not know what's best for himself. A pitcher is going to say, hey, I know my body better than others. It's interesting there. I don't know if Severino deserves the benefit of the doubt with his injury history. That may be another thing, but it's seems like it's getting chippy between the Yankees and Luis Severino. So, like, what's the future look like between the team and the pitcher as he is in his free agent year?
Yeah, very valid points all across the board. This has been building, right? It really is like the last couple of years when he's coming off the IL, he's complained about being slow played. You know, and the Yankees kind of set him up for the playoffs last year and slow played him, and he was not happy about it. And I love that about Severino. I mean, he's a gamer. He wants to be out there. Nobody more disappointed in his injuries than he is in himself. But that's what you want. You want that fire and brimstone attitude from your starting pitchers that they want to be out there. They don't want to waste bullets in the minor leagues. But on the Yankee side, obviously, you know, they have more information. They're privy to the medicals, to the data, the medical data behind the scenes. So, you know, they have a plan, and they're obviously going to err on the side of caution when you have an injury history like Severino. But this isn't just this year. This has been going on the last 2 or 3 years with Severino and him battling with the training staff and getting slow played in his mind. And I love that. I don't have a problem with that at all. But he obviously is a free agent after this year, and it is interesting to follow for the Yankees. And he can't, with all that being said, he has made sure to say, I love playing for the Yankees. And this isn't about that. But yes, I'm frustrated with the trainer staff. They're slow playing me. And then this is nothing new. This is become an annual thing between Luis Severino and the Yankees training staff.
Always nice to err on the side of caution. You love Severino's fight and energy on the field, and that the fact that he wants to compete and get out there right out of the gate here. But it's not about Sunday or this past week or whatever. It's about getting him through the rest of the season unscathed, which if he comes out on Sunday morning in Cincinnati and stays healthy the rest of the year, he can make 18, 20 starts, and that's plenty for a guy with his quality. So here's a guy with a 3.10 ERA since 2017. He was one of the best pitchers in the American League in 17 and 18 when he was actually, you know, pitching full seasons. Then the injuries hit. And even last year, he pitched 100 innings. And with his quality, that's going to be very valuable. And if he can give something like that in another, you know, 20 starts or so, or 16, 18 starts down the stretch, and hopefully for the Yankees into the postseason, that's going to be plenty. But you know why Severino wants to get out there and put up big numbers in his platform season going into free agency.
The one thing that you gain from this side and, you know, watching Luis Severino on the mound, talking to him behind the scenes, his desire to be great is such an admirable trait. And yeah, all players want to be great, but just the way he carries himself, the way he talks about it, something that I really do admire with Luis Severino. And I could see it from both sides. I understand where the Yankees training staff is coming from. I also understand Severino's side. Again, that will to succeed, the desire to be great, obviously it's probably amplified in a contract year. So something to monitor for sure. But I think the Yankees have his best interest in mind for sure as they just want him healthy and available and effective for the month of October. All right, guys, that's going to wrap it up here. Sunday Night Baseball, David, where are you at this weekend?
Back in New York at the Mets, Citi Field. They're going to be the Guardians, Cleveland Guardians against the Mets. We're hoping for a big pitching matchup, maybe Verlander and Bieber. We were hoping for, you know, that all indications are that that's a potential matchup, and love it. You know, it'd be great for the tone for our podcast, Towing the Slab. You know, we'll talk about a great pitching matchup and love watching those guys pitch. The great Verlander, one of the best of his generation. Shane Bieber, a real craftsman, you know, not a 98 mile an hour guy, but a real pitcher and breaking ball artist and fun to watch, who really hits his spots and sets up hitters very well.
All right, David, we'll see you the rest of the week in Toronto and on Sunday Night Baseball. James, keep crushing it. That one sheet is coming in handy here these last couple series, man. Appreciate you on the S broadcast doing the great research you do. Thank you all for tuning in here. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel if you're already not doing so. That way you don't miss the latest extra content that we're putting out, plus the full episodes on the YouTube channel as well. So for David, for James, and for our great producer, Dan Rourke, this is Justin Shackle. We will talk to you next week on Toeing the Slab, Pitching with David Cone, a production of John Boyd Media. Take care, everybody.